curious audience in the dog pound, and I was ready. All those hours studying BET Comic View were finally going to pay off. This was my Comic View moment. I rolled off my set with my trusted self-deprecating opener. I can't take my shirt off at the beach. I'm in shape, but I'm just a small guy with really nice hair. So from the back, I look like a really hot Asian chick. And from the front, I look like a really hot Asian chick. The crowd applauded. I got him. Then I went on with a bit about how I learned English from BET Rap City, the bit Sean Kelly encouraged me to write. The dog pound loved it. I felt confident and pointed over to Arsenio and said, "Me and Arsenio, we're going to do Rush Hour 4. Even Arsenio was clapping on the other side of the stage. I rolled on with the rest of my routine and stuck the landing with my Maury bit, where I observed that I'd never seen an Asian guy in the Maury Povich show, followed by an act out of a fresh off the boat Asian guy on Maury. "Look, Maury, look. He has a big eye. I have a small eye. That's not my baby, Maury." To my absolute surprise, the audience stood up and gave me a standing ovation. All the time watching BET, all the time I spent at the Comedy Palace, and all the crappy unpaid gigs I'd done had culminated in this moment on national television. "Give it up for him!" Arsenio hollered at the audience. He even did a callback on my joke. "Also, check my website, because Rush Hour 4 is coming, y'all!" He gave me a hug and whispered, "You did it. You did it." Those three words meant everything to me. They validated my questionable decision to quit Smith Barney and pursue stand-up comedy. They validated the past 6 years spent at comedy clubs and dive bars. It was the first time someone had ever told me, "You did it." I felt like I finally did something right with my life. I looked up at the audience one last time, and tears welled up in my eyes. Backstage, Arsenio joked, "This is going to be the last time you ever talk to me. You'll be too famous to talk to me after this. Thank you so much for having me on your show, Arsenio. I'm sure I'll talk to you again. Hopefully, I'll be back on the show again." "You got it, man. Would love to have you back." And I never got to go back on the show ever again. 3 days later, the Arsenio Hall show was canceled. CBS had originally signed on for a second season before I went on to the show, but they decided to pull the plug on it 3 days after I went on. Coincidence? Yeah, probably. Or maybe this hot Asian chick was way too hot for America. Either way, I felt lucky that someone dropped out, so I became the very last stand-up comedian to ever perform on the Arsenio Hall show, joining the likes of my heroes like Eddie Murphy, George Lopez, and Andrew Dice Clay. On my following birthday, my friend Jeremy gave me a custom-made poster that said, "You got Arsenio Hall canceled." I now proudly hang this magnificent poster in my living room, as I will cherish this moment forever. Look at the PDF of my apparent curse on Arsenio, and the picture that says, "You got Arsenio canceled." Chapter 6, How to Strip Club DJ. The names of the people in this chapter have been changed in order to protect their identities and my safety. Yes, this chapter is about to get gangster. I had only been to a strip club once in my life when I was 18 years old. Phil took me to a high-end strip club with velvet curtains and chandeliers in Westwood in Los Angeles. I was blown away by how beautiful the dancers were. They didn't even look like strippers. They looked like sorority girls from USC. They probably were actual USC students trying to pay off their astronomical tuition over there. I was not a very confident 18-year-old. And I was sure the strippers could smell the virgin on me. Phil offered to buy me a lap dance, but I was afraid of the unknown behind those VIP curtains, so I turned it down. I wasn't interested in throwing money behind a brass railing in exchange for a pair of blue balls. I wanted to be an insider who knew these girls on a real name basis. I wanted to be a strip club DJ just like Guam. Guam was definitely no role model, but my young and impressionable libido was incredibly envious of him sleeping with 80 strippers. Becoming a strip club DJ was the only way to instantly transform myself from a sexually frustrated chump to a world-class stripper whisperer. Being a strip club DJ became my American dream. I was working at the used car lot during the day and then putting in work at the Comedy Palace every night. Old Larry at the car lot had a friend named Shooter who came to visit him at the lot every week. They knew each other from AA or NAM or something. I forget. I think it was AA. Or maybe it was like AA and NAM. Who knows? Larry lived in Shooter's apartment. When you are 60 years old and you're still crashing at your buddy's apartment, you know you've made some serious mistakes in your life. Shooter was a notorious figure in the San Diego underworld. Word on the streets, Shooter did 20 years of hard time in prison for something involving a dead body. I didn't dare to dig any deeper. He wasn't affiliated with any particular gangs, but all the gangs respected him. Shooter also owned a strip club in San Diego. Shooter was in his 60s. He rocked a thin mohawk and wore a pair of black plastic chopper sunglasses. Have you ever looked at a guy and you know he could kill you without flinching? Well, Shooter looked like he would beat that guy to death with a sledgehammer. Whenever he entered a room, he exuded a dark aura of power. He was like the Undertaker from the WWE, except this was real-life hellfire and brimstone. I was scared, but absolutely fascinated by him. Every time Shooter came in, I looked up at him in awe. I thought gangsters were so cool, let alone a gangster who owned a strip club. Larry had told Shooter that I did stand-up, and Shooter quickly took an interest in my comedy. He probably noticed the admiration in my eyes. The first time he talked to me, I was as nervous as a nerdy high school freshman talking to the starting varsity quarterback. "Hey, kid, I heard you do stand-up," Shooter said to me in his gravelly Mickey Rourke voice. Even though I knew he was a gangster, I tried to stay composed and talk to him like any normal person. "Yeah, I'm usually at the Comedy Palace. You should come by sometime," I replied.
"Sounds good. I can bring some of the girls from the club."
And in case you're wondering, by girls, he meant strippers. I could barely contain my excitement. I couldn't wait to show off my soon-to-be stripper fans to the boys at the Comedy Palace. I realized talking to a gangster is like talking to celebrities. You just have to treat them like normal people and not freak out over who they are. They don't like to be treated differently. They just want a genuine conversation like everyone else. Gangsters have feelings too. That weekend, Shooter rolled up to the Comedy Palace in a white stretch limo. One by one, the girls strutted out of his car. Everyone in the parking lot stopped and stared. I proudly whispered to Guam and Terrell, "That's my boy. That's Shooter." Guam nodded in approval. And without taking his eyes off of the girls, all Terrell said was, "Damn!" It was one of the coolest moments in my life. That night, I felt like a gangster myself. When you're on the good side of a gangster, you feel safe and invincible. All the comedians were extra motivated that night and would put on a killer show. I could see Shooter and the girls clapping their hands, laughing like innocent children. For a moment, Shooter went from a feared gangster to a regular happy audience member. That's the magical thing about stand-up comedy. No matter who the audience member might be, if you can make him laugh, you've got a fan for life. After the show, the girls came up to me one by one to give me a hug. "Oh my God, you were so funny! Hilarious! That was amazing!" These positive affirmations from the strippers felt as legit as a raving New York Times review. Sean, Terrell, and Guam and all the other comedians looked on in awe. I got all the street cred I could ever wish for that night. Then Shooter walked over to me and simply said, "Good job, kid." Then he made his way into his limo. I knew this was my chance. I saw my American dream of working at a strip club flash right in front of my eyes. I seized the moment, and I ducked my head into the limo before Shooter closed the door. "Hey, Shooter, do you need a new DJ for the club?" I nervously blurted out.
"You free this Thursday?"
"Fuck yes!"
And that's how I became a strip club DJ.
Fantasy showgirls. I couldn't sleep for the next few days. I felt like a kid who just got the golden ticket to Shooter's Stripper Factory. All the years of sexual frustration in high school and college would finally be forgotten. This would be my ultimate redemption from Guam and Terrell making fun of me in the back of the Comedy Palace. I pictured the hottest stripper surrounding me as I spun on the ones and twos at a fancy strip club that was kind of like a heaven for dudes. When I stepped foot in the Shooter's Club on Thursday, I realized it was nothing like the paradise I imagined. It was inside an old wooden bungalow in a shady part of town. The exterior was pink and powder blue with an old wooden sign that read, Fantasy Showgirls. There were no velvet curtains or chandeliers. I entered through a giant wooden door and swam through some old crusty purple curtains. And there I was, in the shittiest strip club I'd ever seen. It was nothing like the swanky strip club Phil had taken me to in Westwood. If the Westwood strip club was a Michelin star restaurant, Shooter's strip club would be a taco truck on the side of a gas station. It was a seedy, dystopian joint where dreams came to die. The inside smelled like 10 years of despair and ball sweat, with a hint of stripper lotion. To this day, I'm not sure what strippers put on their bodies, but every stripper wears the same distinct stripper lotion. Nowadays, that smell brings me a satisfying nostalgia. The chairs and VIP booths were old Goodwill quality pieces with suspicious stains on them. But the lights were just dark enough you could trick your mind into not seeing them. There was a bar in the middle of the club. It was a sad, lonely island that only served sodas and Red Bulls. Apparently, under California state law, a fully nude club cannot serve any alcoholic beverages. Only a topless club can serve alcohol, and ours was the fully nude variety. I never really understood that law. I guess the lawmakers thought that the exposure of vaginas mixed with alcohol was the tipping point that would make people's brains explode or something. Everyone knew this. Customers just showed up wasted anyways. It was a sound strategy for veteran perverts. The DJ booth sat a few steps above ground. It was a 5-foot square dim wooden box featuring a simple sawed-out view hole. It had a good vantage point of the whole place, like the sniper towers in San Quentin. The DJ booth had an old Dell computer with all the favorite strip club music, from Motley Crue to Jeremiah. By the way, the editor kept changing Jeremiah to Jeremiah, like putting an A in there because they're like too white to realize it's an R&B singer that's not named Jeremiah. It's Jeremiah, people! Other than the sound system and the microphone, the most essential part of a strip club booth is the lighting board. Lighting in a strip club is just as important as the music. Different girls look better in different lights. For instance, I learned that black girls always look better in green light. Not trying to start a new racial stereotype, it's just a fact. Try it sometime. A tall, intimidating man greeted me. You're the new DJ? My name is Beast. His name was Beast. He was the bouncer who, in fact, looked like a beast. Beast was probably in his 30s, but a lifetime of meth and alcohol made him look like a weathered 50-year-old. He was a skinny 6'4" white guy with a cleanly shaven head and tattoos on his face. I later learned that he was a member of the Aryan Brotherhood when he was in prison. So I'm sure he wasn't too hot on this little Chinese boy spinning at his club. Beast claimed to be a recovering alcoholic, but I'll always see him in the bathroom with a plastic Smirnoff bottle at the end of his shift. I never had any problems with him, but we never really had a heart-to-heart over a nice bottle of wine either. He always just kept to his Aryan self. Everyone at the club had nicknames, the kind you earn in prison. A man named Chef was the bar manager. He was short, but tough. Chef looked like if Joe Pesci was on welfare. As a bartender, he was responsible for overcharging the customers for a splash of Mountain Dew. But more importantly, he was responsible for keeping everyone in check. Chef was in charge of making sure everything was operating smoothly at the club. He was like the enforcer. He was Shooter's trusted old-school boy. One time, Chef told me, I was out of action for a year. Now I'm trying to get back on the grind. I naively asked, so why were you out of action for a year?
Oh, I lost my big toe.
It doesn't get more gangster than losing your big toe. I was guessing he lost it because he owed some money to some bad people. This is the kind of stuff you only hear in like Martin Scorsese movies.
So, how did you lose your big toe?
Diabetes.
Ah, diabetes doesn't care if you're a gangster. It'll fuck you up.
I was never intimidated by Beast or Chef. I thought they were super cool real-life gangsters. I always treated them like normal co-workers. After getting to know them, I soon realized none of them really wanted to be where they were in life. They just fell into it because of a tough upbringing, drugs, or alcohol. If they had a choice to put on a tie and work an honest living at a bank, they would. But the mistakes they made in the past haunted them and would always follow them around. It wasn't cool for them to work at a strip club. It was the absolute last resort. And the same could be said about the strippers. We had an eclectic group of strippers at Fantasy Showgirls. It was like a brochure for community college dropouts. We had an Asian girl fittingly named Jade, a Latina girl uninspiringly named Latina, and two black girls named Milan and Saucy. Although every week Milan would change her name to a different city she has never been to. I always thought that was ambitious of her. Saucy was indeed very saucy. She would talk trash and start physical fights with other strippers. These were definitely not USC students working their way through college. These were career strippers who looked like strippers. I once came into work and witnessed Milan and Saucy wrestling on the ground. Beast and Chef were just casually standing there, passively saying, "Hey guys, come on, break it up." See, breaking up a stripper fight is very similar to dealing with little kids throwing a tantrum. The more you yell at them, the more they're going to yell back. All you can really do is to stay calm and wait for them to tucker themselves out. The stripper fights didn't involve a lot of punches. They went directly for the most expensive part on a stripper, the weave. A winner was determined when one stripper successfully removed the other's weave. Saucy got the better of Milan that night. Milan put up a good fight, but I think she just rocked a loose weave. That was the first time I saw a weave detached from a girl's head. I was caught off guard. They never taught me the anatomy of a stripper's weave in health class. Underneath that weave, Milan looked like a fry cook with a netted cap. Oh, man. One of my jobs was to make sure the strippers went on stage in a timely manner. I always ruled by kindness. I wasn't trying to be a saint. This was merely a work strategy. I was trying to bring professionalism into a shitty strip club. I wanted to give these strippers something they'd never had before. A man who was genuinely kind to them. On the business end, this worked brilliantly. Their shifts were always on time. The girls rotated every three songs like a group of Olympic synchronized strippers. But it didn't help me in scoring with any of the girls. I guess nice guys do always finish last, especially in a strip club. As a nice strip club DJ, I became a trusted friend of the strippers. This also meant I became the last guy they wanted to have sex with. They would sit next to me naked and talk to me about their boyfriends, and I would sit there and nod my head trying to conceal my boner. I didn't even think being friend-zoned by strippers was possible, but I made it happen. I watched naked women dance in front of me every day, but I still couldn't get laid. The strippers sat in the DJ booth naked and told me about their problems, but I still couldn't get laid. There was a stripper giving a hand job 10 feet away from me in the VIP booth, but I still couldn't get laid. I couldn't imagine a more sexually frustrating experience. I had such blue balls, my scrotum looked like the Cookie Monster. I wanted to be like Guam Felix, but I was just a good, innocent Hong Kong Jim. I was actually innocent enough to have a crush on one of the strippers. Paige was a beautiful 19-year-old girl who was our newest dancer. I had a crush on her the moment she walked into the club in her Daisy Dukes. Paige looked like a bright college girl who didn't belong in a strip club. She always had the cutest smile on her face. The main reason I wanted to work in a strip club was to hook up with a couple of strippers. But with Paige, I would marry Paige. She was the girl next door from a Nicholas Sparks movie. I was head over heels for this girl. After her three-song routine, she'll always come by the DJ booth to have a chat with me. That was the highlight of my day. "How did I look out there?" she would ask me, with the prettiest smile on her face. "You look great," trying to remain composed and not propose to her in the strip club. Then she would lean over me naked and pick out the song she wanted for her next dance. "I think that new Jeremiah song goes well with you," I suggested. I was pairing R&B songs with strippers like a sommelier Espago suggesting which red would go best with the beef bolognese. Real artistry there. This sounded like a romantic dialogue from a Pretty Woman sequel. I thought we were going to live happily ever after. But in reality, I was an innocent schmuck and she was just doing her job. Pretty Woman is bullshit. I walked her to her car every night, but I was always too shy to ask her for a number. Weeks went by and I still couldn't muster up the courage to ask her out. I finally gave myself an ultimatum. As I nervously walked her back to her car, I asked her, "You got any plans tonight?" "Oh, I'm going to my boyfriend's house," she casually replied. My heart sank. My crush had a boyfriend. That's a familiar scenario that I'd experienced consistently since middle school. My mind was in denial. I tried to keep my hopes up, hoping maybe one day she would break up with him and run into my arms. Days went by and I was completely out of sorts. I had to talk to someone about this. So, I talked to Shooter. Like a college roommate, I went up to Shooter and said, "Paige is pretty cool, huh?" Hoping to prompt him into a nice conversation about Paige. Without skipping a beat, Shooter said, "Paige? She's a pathological liar. You shouldn't believe a word that comes out of her mouth." Shocked and unconvinced, I asked, "Really? How do you know that?" Shooter laughed and replied, "I fucked her." My innocence died with those words. Lap dance salesman. Shooter taught me the most important thing about selling lap dances was the showcase. A showcase is when a DJ calls all the girls onto the stage for a roll call and pressures the customers to get lap dances. The designated song in our club was the classic strip club anthem, "Girls, Girls, Girls" by Motley Crue. Shooter didn't have many rules, but he was very clear that that song must accompany every showcase. After every third stripper, I would play that song and belt out in my strip club DJ voice, "All right, gentlemen, it's time for our showcase. I want all the girls on the stage right now. We have Jade, Milan, Paige, and the ooh-so-sexy Saucy. We're doing a two-for-one lap dance is going on right now. Get two lap dances with your favorite girl, or get one lap dance with two of your favorite girls at the same time. Don't be shy and don't be tight with your wallet. I want everybody in the VIP. Two-for-one lap dances next 10 minutes. Two-for-one lap dances right now." I will keep repeating that until every customer got a lap dance. The club was never that busy, which meant I kept screaming at two customers until they finally caved into the pressure. Combining the microphone skills I learned from being a comedian and my salesmanship from being a used car salesman, I became an incredible lap dance salesman. According to Shooter, lap dance sales went up 44% the first week I started working there. I never thought Shooter was an accounting whiz, but apparently he was meticulously keeping record of every lap dance sold at his club like Ernst & Young. Shooter was very impressed. He told me I reminded him a lot of himself. See, it's always a good move to compliment someone, then tell him he reminds you of you. It's like patting yourself on the back using the other person's hand. Shooter started giving me more responsibilities at his establishment and really took me under his wing. I felt like Henry Hill earning the trust of Jimmy Conway in Goodfellas. I felt like a made guy. Shooter trusted me so much, he started to have me deliver the cash box from the strip club to his house. In hindsight, this was such a stupidly dangerous job for someone without any protection. I could have easily gotten robbed or killed during my cash delivery trips. But at the time, I didn't put much thought into it. I was just happy the shooter entrusted me with his cash. Every night, Chef would hand me the cash box, and I'll hop into my Toyota Celica and drive to the shooter's apartment at 3 in the morning. At shooter's apartment, there were always a couple of goons passed out on the couch. Till today, I'm not sure if they passed out because they partied too hard, done too much drugs, or that was just their permanent dwelling. I learned to not ask too many questions in a gangster environment. I was always on high alert. I knew there were guns, drugs, and a lot of cash in that house. It was a volatile place. But then, I'd see old Larry from the car lot there, and that eased my mind. It was like going to a new friend's house and seeing an old friend already chilling there playing some video games. Except Larry was usually binge drinking instead of playing Halo. One night, I struggled through the shift with a fever. I popped a couple Advils, but it wasn't helping much. I made my usual 3 a.m. delivery to Shooter's house. There was a different vibe about Shooter that night. He was quiet and serious. I would usually just drop off the cash and leave, but Shooter wanted to have a talk with me. I was in no condition to have a serious talk with a gangster. I was ready to collapse from my illness. I told him I had a fever and I should probably go home, but he insisted I sit down in his kitchen. He grabbed me a glass of water, and he put an unmarked bottle of pills in front of me. "Take this." I asked, "What's this?" He simply replied, "It'll make you feel better." All I could hear was Denzel from Training Day saying, "Didn't know you like to get wet," after he tricked Ethan Hawke into smoking PCP, or as he put it, "Sherms, Dust, PCP, Primos, P-Dog." I've seen Training Day too many times to know that I should decline the pills. And Shooter said, "It's not going to kill you." "What, you don't trust me?" There was an intense moment of silence as I sat there, half coherent, contemplating my next moves. Should I take the pill and hope for the best, or scamper out of the house and go into witness protection? Shooter let out a laugh and said, "I was just kidding. It's just Vicodin. Take some if you want, kid." I took a deep breath. I might have peed my pants a little bit. Shooter's tone got serious again. "You've been doing a good job at the club, kid, and everyone trusts you. I just came into some money, and I'm going to open up a new club. I want you to run it for me." Time stopped, and my brain cranked into hyperfocus. I knew this was one of those life-changing crossroads. People always say your life comes down to a few key decisions that defines you. This was clearly one of them. I had to decide if I wanted to become the underworld strip club king or continue to tell jokes at the Comedy Palace. For a 22-year-old who watched too much gangster rap on BET, this was the toughest decision of my life. "Think about it," Shooter said. I spent the next 3 weeks thinking about nothing but that. It took spending Christmas at the strip club for me to finally decide on my path. A strip club Christmas. It was the saddest Christmas ever. I had no family in San Diego, so I went to my usual 9 o'clock shift at the strip club on Christmas night. A few girls came in, hoping to make some money off people's sorrows. But the place was empty all night. I was actually pretty glad about that. I would have felt really bad for whoever left their family behind to spend Christmas at a strip club. Chef called for an early midnight close, and just when we were about to shut our doors, a pair of drunken college kids around my age stumbled in. A tall white boy and his smaller Indian buddy. Both were drunk as hell. Beast kindly told them to leave as we're already closed for the night, but these kids wouldn't take no for an answer.
"Hey, bro. It says on your Yelp page, you close at 2, the tall one exclaimed.
I was surprised we even had a Yelp page. Beast probably had no idea what Yelp was. I doubt he had to use Yelp in prison.
Beast calmly repeated, "We're closed for the night."
Still not satisfied, the smaller kid said,
"That's bullshit!"
Beast just stared them down with his murderous eyes. The pair finally thought better of it and stomped out. I was sure these kids were going to leave us a 1-star review on Yelp. But we could care less. Our customers were probably not Yelpers. I didn't think much of it and continued my closing routine, cleaning out the DJ booth and shutting down the Dell computer. Suddenly, Beast walked over to Chef and said, "They're still outside talking shit. Let's go." Without hesitation, Chef grabbed the 2x4 antique table leg that he had stashed behind the bar. "Motherfuckers," he said, and he said it in such a determined way, I heard it like it was a war cry from Mel Gibson and Braveheart. Chef and Beast romped out of the door. I wasn't sure what to do, so I sheepishly followed a few steps behind. By the time I got outside, there was already a full-on brawl in the middle of the street. Chef was beating the shit out of the Indian kid with his antique table leg, and the tall kid was wrestling with Beast. I wanted to jump in, but I froze. My brain was smart enough to see what was going on, and it stopped me from proceeding any further. I just stood there and watched it like it was a movie. Chef swung his table leg and gave a couple good legs to the Indian kid's midsection. Then he rushed over to Beast, pulled the tall kid away from him, and threw him on the ground. Beast gave him a hard kick to the midsection. The tall kid writhed in pain. The smaller guy got up slowly and started to limp off. Chef hit him with another stiff table leg to his ribs. The kid gasped, but barely could make any sound. There was a fear of death in their eyes as Chef stared him down. Chef and Beast finally relented before this turned into a homicide, and the college kids hobbled away as fast as they could. Chef screamed out into the distance, "Don't walk, motherfucker! Run!" I stood there, and I couldn't move. Holy shit. What the fuck just happened? I was numb from fear. The fear of fighting, the fear of getting arrested, the fear for my own life. These were just a couple college kids like myself. But now, I'm on the other side of this world. At that moment, I realized I'd joined the dark side. I was no longer a stupid college student like them. I was now on the other side as a grimy strip club employee who hung around gangsters. I finally had a sobering moment when I thought to myself, is this who I want to be? Do I really want to be a gangster? The next day, I tried to play it off like it was a cool story. I bragged to all of my buddies at the Comedy Palace about what happened. I told Terrell, "Yo, so I went outside with Chef and Beast, and those kids were scared, man. Chef beat the shit out of them with that table leg. It was awesome. Then he screamed, 'Don't walk, motherfucker, run!' It was the most gangster shit ever." I made myself sound like such a cool gangster dude, but deep down, I knew what happened was fucked up. Telling my friends was probably my therapy to cope with it. I felt completely out of control. Then I received a call from Sean Kelly. It was a bit odd for him to call me out of the blue in the middle of the day. Usually, we would just chat in person whenever I ran into him at the Comedy Palace. There was a sense of urgency to this call. I picked up the phone, and before I could say hi, Sean said, "You need to get out of that strip club. Now." It was those words that gave me the ultimatum I so desperately needed. He had overheard the strip club Christmas brawl story from Terrell, and he was very concerned. Sean said, "Jimmy, you are young, you are funny. Move to L.A. and focus on your comedy. You need to get out of that strip club before it's too late." That was the wake-up call I needed. I went to work at the strip club that night, but I knew it would be my last. It had to be. It was a quiet night. I was off my game. I wasn't playing the right songs, and I was messing up stripper names. I called Milan Paris. She was not too happy about that. I was on edge all night, waiting for Shooter to come in for his nightly checkup. Shooter finally came in around midnight. For some reason, he looked more intimidating than usual, or at least that's how I felt. I waited until he had greeted all the strippers, and then I went up to him and said, "Shooter, I'm moving to L.A. I'm quitting the strip club." He didn't flinch. In a very matter-of-fact way, he said, "I was going to open up a new club for you and let you run it. You should stay." Although flattered, I knew I had to stand my ground. So I said, "Shooter, I have to go to L.A. to pursue my comedy career." As much as he wanted me to stay, He knew comedy was my passion, and I respected that. So he simply said,
"Okay,"
and he walked away. He understood. As much as Shooter wanted me to be his protege, he knew I was destined for something bigger than a strip club. He let me go. That was the last time I ever stepped foot into Fantasy Showgirls, or any strip club for that matter. After I moved to LA, Shooter kept in touch with me with a monthly phone call from a different number. I always knew it was Shooter when I got a call from a random number with a 619 area code. "Hello?"
"Hey kid, everything good?"
He never introduced himself, but I recognized his voice. "Hey Shooter, yeah, everything is great."
"Okay, just wanted to make sure you're all right."
And then he hung up, and that's all he said, every time. He just wanted to know if I was okay and that nobody was fucking with me. It felt good to know a gangster at my back. I knew if anything were to happen to me, Shooter would take care of it. Shooter might have been a hard-nosed criminal, but he treated me like his son. The calls eventually faded away. A year ago, I ran into a fellow strip club DJ slash comedian friend named Polo the Cholo. Polo delivered the bad news that Shooter had passed away. I felt like I lost a guardian angel. A gangster-ass guardian angel. Every kid who listened to gangster rap and watched Scarface had a fantasy of becoming a glorified gangster. And I was stupid enough to actually try to become one. At least, now I can tell people I gave up a life of crime to become a noble comedian. So what did my parents think about me working at a strip club? I guess I'll find out after they read this book and hear about it for the first time. Sorry, Mom. Chapter 7. How to Make It. Shooter still owed me some back strip club DJ wages when I left San Diego, but I was willing to forego $400 to not confront a notorious gangster. I packed all of my worthless possessions into my two-door, four-cylinder Toyota Celica and headed back to LA. I didn't want to crawl back to my dad's apartment as a failure, and I definitely didn't want to live in that Chinese retirement community again. I'd rather survive on my own with the $2,000 I had in my college check-in account. So I went on to the most trusted site on the internet, Craigslist, and found a living room for rent for $300 a month from a random dude in Hollywood. I had no idea how I was going to make it, but I was determined to never live with a bunch of old ladies talking about their periods ever again. A couple of my comedian friends in LA told me they struck gold in the commercial acting game. My friend Will said he had done an Absolut Vodka commercial 2 years ago. One day of work on that commercial had made him 60 grand in residuals. 60 grand? If I can just book one commercial a year, I'll be rich! 60 grand sounded like $1 million to this retired strip club DJ. I made it my goal in Hollywood to become a filthy rich commercial actor. I just needed to survive on ramen noodles for 6 months until I booked my first commercial. It seemed like a flawlessly sound financial plan. Psst, I can do this. Easy. Then, I quickly realized I had to deal with the age-old question in Hollywood. Where do I start? Will told me he started an extra in that Absolut commercial. Then the actor who was supposed to play the security guard in the commercial didn't show up. So the director picked the biggest, possibly fattest, extra on set and bumped them up to play the security guard as a featured actor. And boom, 60 grand. Will told me about the infamous Central Casting Office in Burbank. It's the first stop for everyone who comes off the Greyhound bus to Hollywood, where they sign up to be an extra. He also told me that if I collected 3 union vouchers for being an extra, then I'll be eligible to become a member of the Screen Actors Guild, the SAG Union. Everyone who has ever been on screen, from Audrey Hepburn to Brad Pitt to vodka commercial Will, is in SAG. Wow, so you're telling me if I sign up to be an extra, I can one day be part of SAG and go down history with Bobby De Niro in Hollywood? That would be beyond my wildest dreams. Little did I know that there were 160,000 members in SAG and 95% of them were unemployed on any given day. But my ignorance outweighed my doubts. I scurried over to the Central Casting office to sign up to be a star. Central Casting is like the open mic for actors. There's zero barrier of entry, and it was filled with desperate people. Every day, there are packs of people lined up to register to be an actor. Everyone had to grab a number and wait in a folding chair inside of a cold gray building just like the DMV. It was more like herding sheep than becoming an actor. You fill out some paperwork, wait for them to call your name, take a passport photo, then off you go to be a star in Hollywood. Yay! They compile a database of people who are willing to work on set for minimum wage, and then they call you if they need a person to blend into the background of a commercial, TV show, or movie. There are many words for extras. Background actors, background artists, and my favorite, atmosphere. I quickly realized this isn't where dreams come true. It's where people would sign up to be warm flesh bags that are as unnoticeable as the air in the atmosphere. There was every type of person waiting to sign up in Central Casting, from a Midwestern mom to an authentic Montana lumberjack to the super good-looking dude who truly believed he was destined to be a star. It was kind of beautiful in its own way to have a place where people who would never hang out with each other came together to pursue the same dream. But, as beautiful as that might sound, realistically, only 1 out of 100,000 or 1 out of 1,000,000 of us fleshbags would ever make it in this town. I'm sure this was the point where many of these people who left their lives behind for their big Hollywood dream realized, fuck, what am I doing here? At least that's how I felt that day at Central Casting. I started to second guess myself for not taking a job at Smith Barney. Maybe I am delusional. And just then, a dude snapped a picture of me, perfectly capturing all my regrets in that moment. That was my first headshot in Hollywood. I was now officially signed up to be a star. Shit. I went home, and by home, I mean a random Craigslist guy's living room with my twin-size mattress. Fuck. Random Craigslist guy was a 20-year-old black dude named Nathan, but he insisted people call him Nathaniel. He was smaller than me, but he had twice the pizzazz, a gay man having the time of his life in Hollywood. I never figured out what he did for a living, but he somehow managed to rent the apartment and throw the occasional party. One night, he invited his buddies, 5 gay Latino dudes to be exact, to the apartment for a little get-together. They seemed like nice, friendly dudes, and I mostly kept myself occupied playing Halo on the Xbox. What Nathaniel didn't tell me was that all 5 of his fabulous Latino hunks planned on crashing an apartment that night, and he could only accommodate one of them in his room. Because, well, Nathaniel believed in monogamy. The other 4 dudes would crash in the living room with me. Whatever. I guess I'll finally have my first all-American slumber party. It was 3 in the morning. I laid down on my bed, but all of them were still taking tequila shots. Then 2 of them started making out right next to my head, and the other 2 were egging them on. I kept my eyes closed, pretending to be asleep. Then I kept hearing one dude repeatedly say, "Hey Pablo, you're a power bottom, huh?" For people who don't know what a power bottom is, I'm not going to explain in this book. Once again, go Google it on UrbanDictionary.com when you're alone. Look, I love gay people. But if anyone, gay or straight, starts talking about taking it up the ass next to me when I sleep, I'm right to feel a little bit uncomfortable. I didn't want to know what was going to happen beyond this point, so I kept my eyes closed, put on my headphones, and start blasting Jay-Z at max volume. Till today, I have no idea what exactly happened that night. All I know is there were 4 dudes with perfectly trimmed eyebrows next to me, and one of them was a power bottom. By the time I woke up, nobody was there anymore. Maybe it was all a dream? It was definitely all a dream, right? There were a lot of things I chose to not understand when I lived with Nathaniel. The second month I was there, he had trouble coming up with his $800 share of the rent. I had already given my precious $300 to him, so this was beyond frustrating. What if he takes my $300 and we still both get evicted? That's bullshit! When I asked him, "Hey, are you going to be able to come up with your rent?" He would just brush me off and say, "Don't worry about it. I'll get it. I try my best to not worry about getting evicted and pray that Pablo or his four friends will loan him some money. It was now the 20th of the month. The landlord had already come and knocked on our door twice, and I was sure the third time was going to be the end. I was about to either be homeless or institutionalized again in the old Chinese people community. I was stressed out so badly, no amount of Halo or Jay-Z could distract me. And Nathaniel was just chilling in his room, without a care in the world. Then around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, there was a knock on the door. I turned off the TV and jumped under my cover, pretending nobody was home. "Coming," said Nathaniel, as he casually cruised out of his room. "What the fuck are you doing? Don't answer that." "It's okay. It's just my friend." Nathaniel opened the door, and it wasn't the landlord. On the other side of the door was a sheepish 70-year-old gray-haired man wearing a cashmere cardigan sweater. They didn't greet each other or even shake hands. Nathaniel led him to his room without saying a word. Then he shut the door behind him and locked it. And once again, I chose to remain ignorant and put on my headphones to Jay-Z's Black Album. 10 minutes later, the old man strolled out of Nathaniel's room and left without ever making eye contact with me. I had no idea what happened in that room that day. All I know is Nathaniel had the rent money after that, and I wasn't evicted. I couldn't even land a job as an extra. I called into the central casting system every day, where there was a pre-recorded message for available extra work. If there was something that fit your look, you would call another number to put your name and headshot in for approval. I called in for a college background kid and Chinatown teenagers several times. But for some reason, I never get a response. Maybe they saw the deep regret of my headshot. Or maybe I was too good looking to blend in with the atmosphere. I'm sure they thought if I was in the background of a TV show, the audience would be so distracted by my beauty, they couldn't concentrate on the show. Like, oh my God, who is that kid in the background eating a sandwich? He's way too hot. I can't even pay attention to this show. Well, at least that's the story I try to tell myself in order to preserve what little ego I had left. A few months went by and I made $0 and zero progress in LA. I was just hanging out at open mics with zero prospects and my strip club savings were running thin. A friend who worked at the comedy store suggested I sign up on the casting websites. Now, casting websites such as LACasting.com and ActorsAccess.com give actors opportunities to submit for acting jobs themselves, without an agent or without any representation. Usually, these jobs are shabby non-union reenactment gigs like America's Most Wanted that pay $100 to play a serial murderer on the loose. I didn't mind working those jobs, and I desperately needed that $100, but the problem was none of them ever really fit my description. I mean, when was the last time you saw an Asian murderer on America's Most Wanted? But what the hell? I had nothing else going on anyways, so I gave it a shot. I signed up for a membership on all the casting sites. It was as desperate as a divorcee signing up for all the dating websites on the internet in search of a new lover. None of these casting sites were free. They were all part of a racket to make money off people's dreams in Hollywood. It cost $15 a month to be a member, $30 to upload a headshot, and $40 to upload an acting reel on each website. I couldn't afford new headshots, which would have cost a cool $500, so I had my friend take a couple amateur headshots of my hair blowing in the wind. I didn't have an acting reel. How was I supposed to have an acting reel if I'd never acted before? So I just put up 2 minutes of my stand-up comedy video. I checked off all the special skills on the website's digital resume. I thought if someone was willing to pay me, I could always learn to ride a unicycle and wrangle some ferrets. On LACasting.com, there's an additional skill set comment box. And I wrote, new in town, good comedic timing, looking for representation. It was the ultimate cry for help. A week later, I got an email from a talent agent that wanted to meet me and potentially sign me as a client. See? Someone has finally discovered my talent. The gamble paid off, and I am destined to be a star. I went down to the local printer and printed out 10 copies of my 8x10 headshot, and I was on my way to meet with my first Hollywood agent. I was nervous. I knew this could be the make-or-break point of my career. I pulled up to my agency's address in my trusted Celica, and it was an apartment building in Santa Monica. I double-checked my email hoping I had the wrong zip code or something, but this was it, a two-story apartment building. I took a peek inside and I saw a clipboard that said, "Commercial agency, sign in here." Maybe this is a personal interview at the agent's home? I don't know. I put down my name and I sat down quietly in the empty lobby. I waited anxiously for 20 minutes. My legs were shaking as I wiped the sweat from my palms on my pants. Then I heard a lady call out, "Jimmy?" I perked up. "Yes, that's me." She gave me a warm smile and said, "Follow me, please." She led me down the hallway and we walked right past the elevators. Every step we took away from the elevators, I became more concerned that I was going to be sold into human trafficking. When we reached the end of the hallway, she opened the door in front of me and said, "Welcome." And there I was. The agency was inside of a fucking apartment rental office. It was a small room filled with IKEA furniture. There was an adjustable desk in the middle of the space. It was $69.99 from IKEA. I knew this because I had taken note of the wooden top with metal legs when I went there last week looking for the cheapest desk I could find. Sitting behind the desk was a stern, bald man with glasses. He flatly greeted me without making any eye contact. "Hello." And before I could reply, he handed me a small piece of paper and said, "Can you read this for me?" I looked down and I started reading. "Staples, where everything you need for back to school is in one..." "Can you read that to the camera?" The man behind the IKEA desk cut me off. I looked up and the lady who let me in was now holding a small Toshiba home video camcorder. She said, "Slate your name, please." "What?" "Just slate your name to the camera." I had no idea what that meant. I froze. And she looked at me exactly how the "What's up, girl" from middle school looked at me. She wasn't sure if I was deaf or dumb or both. She kept her patience and explained, "Slating your name means saying your name to the camera. Just introduce yourself." "Why the fuck didn't you just say that? What the fuck is a slate?" I concealed my rage and I followed her instructions like a good boy. "Hi, my name is Jimmy. I'm originally from Hong Kong. Now I live..." "Just your name is fine." The IKEA desk man cut me off again. "Now read your sides." I had no idea what sides were either, but instead of freezing up again, I assumed it was the generic Staples commercial he had handed me, so I started. "Staples, where everything you need for back to school is in one store. Staples, make more happen." "Okay, thanks." And that was it. The lady put the camcorder down and ushered me out of the rental office slash agency. Well, I blew it. I blew my shot in Hollywood because I didn't know what slate meant. My barrier with the English language had come back to knock me down in the most important interview of my life. All my English training and watching BET Rap City meant nothing. I sucked so bad I was rejected by a commercial agency in an apartment rental office. Time to call it quits and move back to my dad's. It was stupid of me to think that I could make it as anything in Hollywood. I was obviously destined to be a quiet financial advisor like the nice Asian boy my dad wanted me to be. I wallowed under my covers on my twin-size mattress for the next few days as my self-loathing took over. I got a call to do a stand-up gig in Paso Robles, a desert wine town in the middle of nowhere in California. It was 4 hours away for a $50 paycheck. So I hopped into my Celica and journeyed to briefly escape from my grim reality in Hollywood. The show was in a bar converted from a barn. It smelled like whiskey and cow shit. I was asked to do 25 minutes, but I really only had 15 minutes of material at the time. 10 extra minutes on stage doesn't sound that long, but that's a lifetime when you run out of material. It's like being on a first date and completely running out of things to say, so you sit there twiddling your thumbs wanting to kill yourself. Except, instead of one girl judging you, it's 100 drunk people judging you on a brightly lit stage. But hey, I needed those 50 bucks to upload a couple more headshots on LA casting. I went on stage and the drunken crowd wasn't very interested in seeing what this no-name comedian had to say. They just wanted to drink, and they honestly preferred some music from the jukebox than a live comedian. I got some chuckles here and there, but none of the jokes really hit. Half the crowd was talking over me, and the other half was busy ordering drinks from the bar. I got through all my material in 20 minutes, and now I had to attempt to do some crowd work for another 5. So, hey, how long have you guys been together? I asked the couple in the front row. Silence. What about, when did you guys meet? Nothing. Was it a grocery store? You guys look like a grocery store couple. No. Oh, it was bad. But I got through it without anyone throwing a glass or screaming racial slurs at me. Luckily, I got my pay in cash and the bar manager was sympathetic enough to offer me a free meal. I accepted a $9 cheeseburger, so my payments came out to be a total of $59.88 if you include the tax on the cheeseburger. After spending $30 on gas, I got out of Dodge with $20 in my pocket and $9 in my stomach. All that just to live another day in LA. Maybe I should quit comedy and start doing what Nathaniel did to that old man. The next morning, I had another agency appointment from LA Casting. I was exhausted from the 8-hour round trip from the night before, and I didn't know if my body could physically take any more shaming. I would have stabbed myself with a samurai sword and ritually seppuku'd myself if I was rejected by another apartment rental office agency. And this agency was all the way in Torrance, about an hour south of Hollywood. My appointment was at 10 a.m., and I didn't even bother setting an alarm to wake up for it. However, I was woken up by Nathaniel and his hot Latin lover friend making coffee at 8. And as much as I wanted to, I just couldn't go back to sleep. I rolled around with my mattress for a while, and Nathaniel asked, "What do you got going today?" "Nothing. I have another stupid agency meeting, but I don't think I'm gonna go. It's all the way in fucking Torrance." "You should go. What do you have to lose?" Nathaniel was probably trying to get me out of the house so he could get some alone time with his hot Latin lover. But he was right. I just drove 4 hours for a $50 gig in a barn, and I think I'm too good to meet an agent? So I pulled myself together and headed for Torrance. I wanted to turn around during every minute of that hour-long drive. The whole time I was praying I wouldn't pull up to another apartment complex. I would have cried and crashed my car into that rental office. Luckily, I found myself in a nicely gated office building with a legitimate security guard. Instead of a sign-up sheet in the apartment lobby, I had to show my driver's license to get into the building.
"Your name is not in the system," the security guard told me.
"Oh, my name is Manxing on my license, but I go by Jimmy."
"Okay, Jimmy. Elevator to your right."
Yes! I get to use the elevator this time! Oh my god! I went upstairs and I was greeted by an actual receptionist. "Hi, I'm here to see Jane at Vesta Talent Agency. My name is Jimmy."
"Jane will be right with you."
As standard as that exchange might have seemed, it was a positive 180 from the previous nightmarish experience. This time, I wasn't nervous at all. I expected nothing, and I had nothing to lose, not even my pride. I guess it was pretty liberating to hit rock bottom. I waited for a few minutes, and a woman wearing a perfectly pressed pantsuit came out to greet me. "Hi, Jimmy. I'm Jane. Pleasure to meet you." She seemed professional, and she didn't hand me a slip of paper with a fucking Staples commercial on it. I was already sold. Jane was a skinny woman who carried a charming smile on her face. But at the same time, there was also a deep intensity about her. We sat down in an empty conference room, and she told me Vesta Talent was a one-woman boutique agency, and she used to be an actress from Juilliard. Whenever she wasn't smiling, she stared deep into my eyes with intent. You could tell she used to be a good actress, and now she was a fierce agent. She called Vesta Talent the Ivy League agency. I was impressed, but it didn't take much to wow this beginner who bombed an audition in front of an IKEA desk. She said to me, I think you have a good look. I later learned that having a good look is quite different than being good looking. In Hollywood, having a good look